respect for that very kind introduction. Brother Cornell and I have a great relationship. It's a relationship that's integrated around a common theme. You know, to have a good friendship, you need something in common. And what we have in common is a profound desire to straighten the other one out. And we both share that. I'm not quite sure what Professor Beck means in saying that this is a blue card event, but I gather that you get a blue card for attending. And if the blue card is good for a beer at one of the taverns in the town, I just want to note that I'm attending too. I apologize in advance for the length of this lecture, but the theme that I'm talking about this afternoon, natural law, God, and human rights, is obviously a big one. And I want to do the topic justice. So I will ask for a great deal more of your time than I'm entitled to. And if anybody has to leave or just gets bored to death, I won't be offended. But I will go on for some time because I want to do the job right. I don't believe that we have innate knowledge of anything. All of our knowledge, including our knowledge of natural law, begins with experience, but it does not end there or even tarry there. Knowing, the activity of using one's mind, understanding, figuring things out, knowing is an intellectual activity. We all have the experience of knowing, but to know is not merely to experience. Knowing is a complex and dynamic activity. Whether we're trying to understand something in the domain of physics or chemistry, or something in the domain of sociology or economics, or something in the domain of philosophy and ethics. Any knowing, any project of understanding, is a complex and dynamic activity. It begins with experience. The role of experience in the activity of knowing is to supply data on which the inquiring intellect works in the cause of achieving the goal, understanding, moving from less to more of a grasp of what's going on in any field, deepening one's understanding. Insights in any field, including in ethics, are insights into data. They're not data free. They are, as the philosophical theologian Bernard Lonergan brilliantly demonstrated in a book called Insight, by inviting readers to observe and reflect on their own ordinary intellectual operations, the fruit of a dynamic process, an integrated and dynamic process, of experiencing, understanding, and judging. The mind is not passive, simply recording impressions, as if knowledge were simply a matter of experience. The mind is rather active. Experience provides the data on which the inquiring intellect works in the cause of yielding insights. But the mind must do its part. It must grasp. It must judge. So what are the data supplied by experience that are at the foundations of our practical judgments? Let's just move from general knowledge of anything to the specific domain that we're interested in today, what Aristotle called practical knowledge, which includes moral knowledge. Knowledge that is not of what is the case about the physical world or social phenomena, but rather what is to be done by you or me, or what is not to be done, what is to be avoided because it's wrong. What are the data supplied by experience that are at the foundation of our practical judgments? That is, insights that constitute knowledge of natural law. Well, they are the objects of intelligibly choice-worthy possibilities. And by that I mean possibilities that, in as much as they provide reasons for our choices and actions of a certain sort, that is, more than merely instrumental reasons, we grasp not as bare possibilities, but we grasp as opportunities. That's very abstract. Let me say concretely what I mean. There are things that it is possible for you or me to do that are pointless, and no one would do them. At least no one would do them just for their own sakes. There are some activities that may be intelligible as means to other ends, but considered as possible ends in themselves, they are simply not intelligible, precisely because they're pointless. It is possible, isn't it, for Professor Beck to move over to the door there and stand on one foot for a half an hour opening and closing that door. It's possible. But if he were to do that, not for any instrumental reason, not to get some air into the room, not to get some exercise, not to put on a display, not to make a philosophical point, but rather, when we questioned him, said that, well, he was doing it for its intrinsic benefits, just for its own sake, we'd call the guys with the white coats to come. Because that activity considered just as something that could be done for its own sake doesn't compute. It's possible, he could do it, but it's not the kind of thing that provides an intelligible, non-instrumental reason for action. Now notice that distinction between ends or purposes that provide instrumental reasons. I open and close the door to get some air in the room. I open and close the door to make a philosophical point. I open and close the door to get some exercise. Distinguish those ends or purposes that provide instrumental reasons from those whose intelligibility as a reason doesn't depend on any further or deeper reason or subrational motivating factor to which it's a means. In other words, a more than merely instrumental reason for action. Well, are there such things? I would submit to you that there are. In our experience of true friendship, for example, an experience all of us have, we've all had the experience of having or being a friend. We grasp in that experience by what is ordinarily an effortless exercise of what Aristotle called the practical intellect, that is, the intellect inquiring and acting with a view to action, what to do. We grasp in our experience of ordinary friendship by an effortless exercise of our practical reason the intelligible point of having or being a friend. We see the point, even where the point is not something instrumental. We understand that friendship is desirable not merely for instrumental reasons. Indeed, a purely instrumental friendship would be no friendship at all, would it be? But above all, for its own sake. Now, that's not to say that friendship or other ends or purposes that are intrinsically, that provide intrinsic reasons for action, can't also have instrumental benefits. Often our friendships do. Perhaps because I'm a friend of Sally's, I get invited to the parties with all the beautiful people because she's a social aristocrat. Or because I'm friends with Bill, I'm going to get a good job because Bill's father is the head of a big corporation that is handing out great jobs to people with my skill set. So our friendships can have instrumental benefits. But if all we're interested in each other, you and me, or me and Bill, or Sally and me, is the instrumental value of our friendship, then whatever we have, it's not a friendship. We might be perfectly civil to each other. We might sort of like each other. But if we're only using each other for instrumental purposes, even if not doing so unjustly, that's not a friendship. But we all have the experience of being in a relationship that's not valued by us simply for its instrumental benefits, but rather for its own sake. So, if you hear that I spent yesterday evening, when I could have been getting some work done, watching TV, going out to dinner with my wife, but you understand, you learned that I went to the hospital to visit a friend, perhaps a friend who was dying and who was so deeply under the narcotic painkillers that he had to be given that he was barely aware that I was there, coming in and out of consciousness. If you heard that I did that, you wouldn't be left baffled, scratching your head, saying, why would somebody do that? That's pointless. Even if you yourself would not have done it, even if you would have said, well, look, I think I'd spend the evening at home watching TV. And even though you recognize that I didn't have any moral obligation to do it, I would have been doing nothing wrong had I spent the evening getting some work done or being with my wife, you would still understand that it's not a pointless activity. It wouldn't be like standing on one foot and opening and closing that door for a half an hour just for its own sake. If I go to visit my friend, not because I hope at the last minute I'm going to get in on his will or for any other instrumental benefit, but just for the sake of friendship, that's intelligible. You can understand it. And that's because you do see the point of friendship as providing a more than merely instrumental reason for action. And you can see that even in cases where, for the sake of friendship, considered as more than a merely instrumental value, someone does something morally wrong. Let's say that Professor Beck is aware that I have done something disgraceful. The kind of things professors do sometimes, like use money from your research account to go out for dinner. Right? He's learned that I've done something disgraceful. But we're friends. And so when a faculty colleague comes to him and says, "Hey, I've heard some juicy gossip about our colleague George. Turns out he's embezzling from his research account. He's a thief." And Professor Beck, knowing that in fact I'm guilty, out of friendship for me says, "No, that's false. I've looked into that. It's not true. He didn't do it." Now, he's done something that's morally wrong. He's told a lie. He's done it for the sake of our friendship, but it's still wrong. But being wrong doesn't mean being unintelligible. It's still intelligible that he would do it. When you hear that he did it, you're not left baffled, scratching your head, saying, "Why on earth would somebody do that? I don't see the point of that." You see the point, even if you disagree with his doing it. It's not like standing on one foot and opening and closing the door. And what that shows you is, even apart from any consideration of a moral question, before questions of morality even arise, we grasp certain ends or purposes like friendship as providing intelligible, more than merely instrumental reasons for our choices and actions. So because we grasp the intelligible point of having and being a friend, and we understand that the fundamental point of friendship is friendship itself, and certainly not goals that are extrinsic to friendship or to the activity of friendship, such that friendship would only be a means, like getting into somebody's will, getting a job, getting invited to the great parties, we reasonably judge that friendship is intrinsically valuable. We know that friendship is a constitutive and irreducible aspect of human well-being and fulfillment, and that precisely as such, friendship provides a reason for acting of the sort that requires for its intelligibility as a reason, no further or deeper reason or subrational motivating factor to which it is a means. Now, that doesn't mean that anything you do for friendship or for the sake of friendship is right. We haven't gotten to moral questions yet. We haven't gotten to moral norms yet. I want us to get there. I want to take us there. Right now, I'm just trying to establish the intelligibility of certain purposes, ends, activities as intrinsically fulfilling of the human person, even though they might be reasons that sometimes lead us to do things that are in violation of moral norms, like the norm against lying or stealing or what have you. Now, what I said about friendship can be shown by reference to any of a range of other activities, ends, purposes that are intelligible as providing more than merely instrumental reasons for action, including the very thing that we are here together to do this afternoon, the pursuit of knowledge or understanding. Let's shift our focus to this activity, to the very thing we're doing right now. I'm speaking, you're listening, you're trying to figure out whether what I'm saying is true, whether it makes sense, whether there are counterarguments that would undermine what I'm saying. I'm trying to figure those things out even as I speak to you. In our experience of wonder and curiosity, the ordinary experiences all of us have from the time we were little children, our experiences of wonder, curiosity, of raising questions and devising strategies for obtaining answers, of executing those strategies by carrying out lines of inquiry, and not just in classrooms, but think of a little kid who's gotten a new toy. He's trying to figure out how the toy works, so he starts taking the thing apart. He's trying to execute a strategy that in his little mind he's already sorted out to figure out how the thing works. And ultimately of achieving insights, figuring out how the thing works, figuring out whether there's anything to the idea of natural law or ethics. We grasp, again, by what is for most people in most circumstances an effortless exercise of practical reason, the intelligible point of searching for truth, trying to reach understanding, and finding it. We understand that knowledge, understanding, intellectual activity, though it may have tremendous instrumental value, get us good jobs, give us something interesting to say at cocktail parties, what have you, all sorts of instrumental value, is intrinsically valuable as well. Its value is not entirely exhausted by whatever instrumental value it has. In other words, to be attentive, well-informed, thoughtful, clear-headed, careful in one's thinking, critical and judicious in one's judging. To be those things is to be inherently enriched in a key dimension of our lives as human beings. Right? We understand that it's possible to be attentive, thoughtful, careful, critical, intelligent, judicious. Not just to believe the last thing somebody told you or the last thing you read in the newspapers or saw on TV, but to inquire, to think critically, to be a little skeptical. You can be like that, or you can be inattentive, kind of dull-witted, you know, uncritical in one's thinking, prepared to believe whatever the last thing someone told you, poorly informed. And we can understand the point of activities that are supposed to move us from the latter condition to the former. Getting an education, right? Trying to think more carefully, disciplining one's own thinking for the sake of the enrichments that are inherently on offer by virtue of being attentive, clear thinking, critical, judicious, careful. We reasonably judge the activity of knowing then to be an intrinsic, or what some philosophers call a basic human good. That is a constitutive and irreducible aspect of our flourishing as human beings. Like friendship and a number of other types of activity, knowledge is another example of an end or purpose that provides a reason for choice and action that requires, for its intelligibility, no further or deeper reason to which it's a mere means. Knowledge of natural law, then, knowledge that begins with our grasp of what provide our most basic reasons for action, is not innate. It does not swing free of experience or the data provided by experience. The experience of friendship, the experience of being curious about something, figuring out a strategy for how you're going to understand it, reaching the understanding. Even when it is easily achieved, practical knowledge, that is, knowledge of natural law, is an achievement. It's the fruit of insights, which, like all insights, are insights into data, data which are supplied by experience. The insight, the knowledge, that friendship, for example, or knowledge, is intrinsically humanly fulfilling, is part of our flourishing as human beings, is ultimately rooted in our experiences of these activities. Apart from those experiences, there would simply be no data on which practical reason could work to yield understanding of the intelligible point, and thus the value of friendship or knowledge, and the judgment that these activities, unlike just standing on one foot and opening and closing a door, are intrinsic fulfillments of the human person, and as such, objects of the primary principles of natural law. Now, as you can tell from my example of someone lying for the sake of friendship, not all practical knowledge is moral knowledge. To know that friendship has an intelligible point, to grasp the point of friendship, so that one can act for the sake of it, by visiting a friend in the hospital or by lying to cover a friend's misdeeds, to know that friendship provides that kind of reason is not to know anything yet about morality. It's not to know whether it's right or wrong, in this case or that case, to act for the sake of friendship, by lying, for example. So though not all moral knowledge is practical knowledge, not all practical knowledge is moral knowledge, all moral knowledge is practical knowledge. That is, moral knowledge is a subset of the whole that includes practical knowledge that's not itself, strictly speaking, moral knowledge, like the knowledge that friendship or intellectual activity or aesthetic appreciation or the pursuit of virtue itself provides a more than merely instrumental reason for action. Yet knowledge of the most fundamental practical principles, those that I've been talking about, like the principles that we grasp when we see the point of acting for friendship or knowledge or the appreciation of paintings or art or ballet or football or chess, those, our knowledge of these practical principles, though not strictly speaking knowledge of moral norms, is foundational to the generation and identification of such norms. And that is because, and here we move from the most basic principles of practical knowledge to moral questions and the identification of moral norms. That is because moral norms are principles that guide our actions in line with the primary practical principles integrally conceived, that is, conceived in their full, variegated fullness, in their wholeness, in their richness, knowledge, friendship, aesthetic appreciation, the development of skills, the appreciation of skillful performances, and so forth. Norms of morality, then, are, in my opinion, entailments of the integral directiveness of the various aspects of human well-being and fulfillment that together constitute the ideal of integral human fulfillment. Now, integral human fulfillment is not something anybody can act for. It's merely an ideal. You can't, by an action, bring about integral human fulfillment. That is, the fulfillment of all persons and all communities that they form in all of the dimensions in which human beings can be fulfilled. When you can act for the sake only of one or some set of ends or purposes that provide intelligible reasons, and provide them by virtue of being aspects of our flourishing as human beings. Now, you can act in a way that respects all the others, but obviously priorities have to be made. I might devote my life to the cause of justice, but that means I can't at the same time and equally devote my life to the cause of scholarship or to the cause of art or something like that. Our actions are limited because we're finite. And there are an innumerable number of ways in which limitless numbers of people can instantiate the basic human goods that provide our most basic reasons for action, those aspects of our well-being and flourishing as human beings. So if the first principle of practical reason is, as Aquinas famously put it, that good is to be done and pursued and bad is to be avoided, and I'm very confident Aquinas here doesn't mean morally or mean just morally good or bad. By good is to be done and pursued and evil is to be avoided, he means the good or the good is that which gives you reasons for action of a more than merely instrumental sort, and the bad is what are privations of those goods. So if that's the first principle of practical reason, then the first principle of morality, so the first principle of practical reason will cover all practical reasoning, including morally bad reasoning. It's acting on that principle that enables someone to know that friendship has a point sufficiently that he might lie for it. So we need a first principle of morality, and it seems to me that that principle would be something like one ought always to choose and otherwise will in a way that is compatible with a will toward integral human fulfillment. Here I come down in the big debate, the big historic debate about ethics on Kant's side of the divide that understands morality is fundamentally about rectitude in willing. You can't really ultimately control all the consequences of what you do, but you can control what you will and don't will, and that morality is fundamentally about rectitude in willing. And just as the first principle of practical reason is specified, as Aquinas makes clear by identifying the various irreducible aspects of human well-being and fulfillment, namely friendship, knowledge, aesthetic appreciation, skillful performance, religion in the sense, at least the general sense, of trying to understand what, if any, sources there are of more than human value and meaning, and if there are such sources, getting yourselves in line with them. So, too, the first principle of morality is specified by identifying the norms of conduct that are entailed by a truly open-hearted love of the human good in its variegated richness, that is, in its wholeness. That's what it means to will the good of a human person in the classic sense of love, which is not just a feeling, but an act of willing, willing the good of the other for the sake of the other. In loving the human person, what you act for are those aspects of human well-being that are the goods of persons. And so a good will be a will that's specified by positive orientation toward the good of human persons in all of its dimensions. So as you see, natural law theorists of my particular ilk understand human fulfillment, the human good, as variegated. We're not proposing that there's this one thing out there that is the good, and everybody should act for that thing. There are many irreducible dimensions of human well-being. That is, the human good is variegated in such a way that its human goods are not reducible to each other or to some common factor, something that they all have in common but only manifest differently or in different quantities or something like that. So for those of you who've done some philosophy, I would say that we predicate goodness of all the ends or purposes that provide our reasons for action, more than merely instrumental reasons for action, not univocally, that is, all in the same way, as if they all were made of the same substance and only manifested it differently. Rather, we predicate goodness of the various forms of human good, the aspects of our flourishing as human beings, analogically. That is, they're not the same substance. What they have in common is this and only this. Each of them is capable of providing a more than merely instrumental reason for our actions. Each of them is capable of providing a non-baffling answer to the question, why on earth would someone do that? What's the point of doing that? Whether the doing that is something morally good, visiting a friend in the hospital, morally bad, telling a lie. Now, to affirm the variegated nature of the human good is not to deny that human nature is determinate. When I make this point to some audiences, people will think, okay, you're a funny kind of natural law theorist because you must think that the human good is indeterminate. No, I do think that human nature and the human good is determinate. I'm simply affirming that our nature, though determinate, is complex. Now let's think of some of the ways in which we really are complicated, complex critters, ways that are highly relevant to our flourishing overall, our integral flourishing as human beings. First of all, we are animals, but we are rational. We're organisms, you know, like monkeys and trees and amoeba, but we're an unusual kind of organism. We're rational. Our integral good, therefore, includes our bodily well-being, to be sure. We're better off being healthy, robust, strong with it than being dilapidated, sickly, fallen apart, right? We can flourish or fail to flourish in respect of our health because we're not angels or spirits, we're organisms. Yet, at the same time, our integral good includes our intellectual well-being because we're rational. We really can be attentive, sharp, critical, careful, judicious, or inattentive, careless, muddle-headed, kind of stupid, injudicious, willing to believe the last thing someone told you. And we can act for the sake of our intellectual flourishing, just as we can act for the sake of our physical well-being. In the physical case, we can lose some weight, stop smoking, get some exercise, eat a better diet. Are those things pointless? No, they're not pointless. We understand the point of them because we understand the point of health. We understand that we're organisms, and as such, part of our integral flourishing is our physical well-being. Same is true, though, on the intellectual side. We can act for the sake of, in the old-fashioned, but I think never surpassed language, improving our minds. Reading Shakespeare. Thinking about or studying the causes of the First World War. Working on math problems, or even crossword puzzles, and so forth. But that's not the whole picture of our complexity. There's a lot more. We also, as part of our integral good, must consider our moral well-being. We are creatures who have moral characters. Lions don't have those. Lions don't make judgments or form their characters based on deliberation about the morality or immorality of bringing down a gazelle. But we do, as Aristotle taught us. We can become virtuous by doing virtuous acts or vicious by doing wrongful acts. And so a dimension of our overall flourishing is our moral character. We can tell the difference between Mother Teresa and Adolf Hitler. Even if they're both equally intelligent, even if they're both physically in just as good shape, we can tell that Mother Teresa is flourishing in a way that Hitler's not, because she has a good and strong moral character, and he has a very wicked one. Think of more ways in which we are complicated. We come packaged as individuals, right? We're individual organisms. But friendship and sociability are not merely means to extrinsic ends for us, getting invited to cocktail parties, getting good jobs. Friendship and sociability are themselves constitutive aspects of our flourishing. As Aristotle taught yet again, not only is man a rational animal, man is a social animal. Part of our fulfillment is in being in rich and good relationships with others. In A Christmas Carol, you've all read or seen the movie A Christmas Carol, right? We can tell the difference between Fezziwig and Scrooge. Between a man who has good relationships, healthy relationships with others, who's flourishing in the social dimension of his life, and somebody who's friendless. Somebody who just doesn't get along with people, doesn't like people. What's that? Misanthropic. Right? Scrooge is the ultimate misanthropic guy. Fezziwig is the very opposite. Do we see the point of being more like Fezziwig and less like Scrooge, even apart from morality? Yeah, we do. Well, by reflecting on the basic goods of human nature, especially those most immediately pertaining to social and political life, natural law theorists propose to arrive at a sound understanding of principles of justice, including those principles we call human rights. Now, in light of what I've already said about natural law theorists and how they understand human nature and the human good, it should be no surprise to learn that natural law theorists typically reject both strict or extreme individualism on the one hand and collectivism on the other. Individualism, at least in its radical forms, overlooks the intrinsic value of human sociability and tends to understand human relationships only as means to extrinsic ends of the persons who enter into the relationships. They're in them for what they can get out of them, where what they can get out of them is considered something extrinsic to the relationship itself. Collectivism compromises the dignity of human beings by tending to instrumentalize and subordinate them, human persons, and their well-being to the interests of larger social units. The state, the Volk, the Fuhrer, the future communist utopia, whatever it is. The individual is just a cog in the wheel whose interests can be utterly sacrificed for the sake of the larger whole or the greater good. Individualists and collectivists both have theories of justice and human rights, some rather interesting ones, but they are, as I see it, highly unsatisfactory. They are rooted in important misunderstandings of human nature and the human good. Neither, it seems to me, on either extreme, can do justice to the key concept here, which is the concept of a human person. That is, a rational animal who is a locus of intrinsic value and is such an end in himself who, as Kant reminds us, may never legitimately treat himself or be treated by others as a mere means to other ends, but whose well-being intrinsically includes relationships with others and membership in communities, beginning with family, in which he or she has, as a matter of justice, both rights and, ordinarily, responsibilities. So it seems to me that radical individualism overlooks the intrinsic value for human beings of our relationships with others. Collectivism fails to understand a human person properly because it doesn't abide by the norm that human beings are ends in themselves and may not be reduced to the status of mere means. Human rights exist if it's the case that there are principles of practical reason directing us to act or abstain from acting in certain ways out of respect for the well-being and dignity of persons whose legitimate interests may be affected by what we do, whether it's in warfare or in economic matters or what have you. Now, I certainly believe that there are such principles. So I believe in human rights. They cannot be overridden by considerations of utility. That's what it means for there to be a right. At a very general level, they direct us, in Kant's phrase, to treat human beings always as ends and never as means only. When we specify this general norm, we identify important negative duties, such as the duty to refrain from enslaving other people. Although we need not put the matter in terms of rights, it's perfectly reasonable and I believe helpful to speak of a right against being enslaved and to speak of slavery as a violation of human rights. Now, there are some moral and political philosophers, especially some Christian moral and political philosophers, who think that the language of rights or the concept of rights just has no proper place in moral and political theory. That to deploy the concept of rights is already to buy into an individualist libertarian view of the world that is incompatible with a sound understanding, or what Christians would understand as a sound understanding, of human sociability and of justice. But it seems to me that while the concept of rights can be and has been abused, sometimes treated as if rights are the only currency in moral analysis or moral discourse, sometimes the emphasis on rights plainly has caused people to neglect to see the importance of responsibilities and duties and so forth. Still, it seems to me that carefully deployed, having in mind the possibilities of abuse, the concept of rights can be very usefully deployed in the cause of understanding our obligations to others. So I think there are human rights, rights people have not by virtue of being members of a certain race or sex or class or ethnic group, but simply by virtue of our humanity. But there are, in addition to negative duties and their corresponding rights, certain positive duties. And these two can be articulated and discussed in the language of rights, though here it seems to me especially important that we be clear about and by whom, that we be clear about by whom and how a given right is to be honored. Sometimes it's said, very recently in the healthcare debate, for example, that education or healthcare is a human right. It's kind of become a trope of political rhetoric. Now, it's certainly not, to my mind, unreasonable to speak this way. I don't think that this is unintelligible, but much more needs to be said if those kinds of statements are to be meaningful statements. Some questions have to be answered. Who is supposed to provide education or healthcare or any other positive good to whom? Why should those persons or institutions, rather than other persons or institutions, be the providers? What place should the provision of education or healthcare occupy on the list of social and political priorities? Since you're talking about finite resources and prioritization, whoever is going to be the provider has to be done. Is it better for education or healthcare to be provided by governments under socialized systems, or by private providers in markets, or by some combination of government and market? Now, the key thing I want you to see here, however you come down on the substantive questions of education or healthcare and how it's to be provided and by whom, I want you to see that these questions go beyond the application of moral principles. So they require a kind of analysis that is not required in the case of negative duties and their corresponding rights, or negative rights and their corresponding duties, such, to take a no longer controversial example, as the right against slavery. These questions require prudential judgments in the light of contingent circumstances people face in a given society at a given point of time. They require a knowledge not just of moral principles, but of economics, of psychology, of sociology, of history, that is not a substitute for, or can be supplied by, moral analysis. Often there's not a uniquely correct answer. The answer to each question can lead to further questions, and the problems can be extremely complex, far more complex than the issue of slavery or any other negative right or duty, where once a right has been identified, its universality and the basic terms of its application are fairly clear. Everybody has a moral right not to be enslaved, and everybody an obligation, as a matter of strict justice, to refrain from enslaving others. Governments have a moral obligation to respect and protect the right, and correspondingly, to enforce the obligation. Now, there are some additional questions, of course, that have to do with, for example, what is the most effective way for a government to protect a particular right. But that level of complexity going beyond moral principles is nothing like the measure of complexity that gets introduced when we're talking about positive rights and duties. Well, what I've said so far, I hope, will provide a pretty good idea of how I think we ought to go about identifying what are human rights. But in each case, the argument must be made, and in many cases, there are complexities to the argument. It's obviously not enough, whether we're speaking of a negative or a positive right, to simply assert that there is a right. You need an argument for it, and sometimes the arguments are complex. One basic human right that almost all natural law theorists would say belongs in the set is the right of an innocent person not to be directly killed or maimed. This is a right that is violated when someone makes the death or injury of another person the precise object of his action. It's the right that grounds the norm against targeting non-combatants, even in justified wars, and against abortion, euthanasia, the killing of hostages, and so forth. Of course, in the case of abortion, some people argue that human beings in the early stages of development, in the embryonic or fetal or infant stages, do not yet qualify as persons and so do not possess human rights. You can be a believer in human rights, but you might believe that this class of human beings are not persons and therefore do not qualify as bearers of human rights. And in the case of euthanasia, some argue that permanently comatose or severely mentally disabled or demented people do not or no longer qualify as rights bearers. My colleague at Princeton, Peter Singer, though he is not one who speaks in the language of rights, but rather holds to a utilitarian philosophy, argues on the question of personhood that we need to distinguish between being a human being and being a person, and that not all human beings qualify as persons. He also thinks there are people who, entities or beings that could qualify as persons even though they're not human beings. So according to Singer, human beings in the very earliest stages, though they're human beings, he doesn't argue in favor of abortion or infanticide on the theory that we don't know when life begins. He says, no, the human life has begun, these are human beings, but they're not yet persons because they haven't yet achieved a certain level of mental functioning that would qualify them as persons, having self-awareness and so forth. Or people who are suffering from severe dementias or in persistent vegetative states or minimally conscious states are no longer human beings. So on his account, you can have people who are not yet human beings, people who were human beings but are no longer, are not yet persons, human beings who are not, who were once persons but are no longer persons, and then severely, congenitally, mentally handicapped people who never were, are now, and never will be persons. Now, I think these claims are mistaken, but I won't go here into my reasons for holding that the moral status of a human being does not depend on his or her age or size or stage of development or degree of mental development or condition of dependency. I've presented this argument in great detail in numerous places, including most recently in a book I wrote with Christopher Tollefson called Embryo, A Defense of Human Life. Here I'll only say that people who do not share with me the conviction that human beings in early stages of development or those in severely debilitated conditions are rights bearers may nevertheless agree that whoever qualifies as a person is protected by the norm against direct killing of the innocent. May. So someone like my former teacher Ronald Dworkin would hold that view, although someone like Professor Singer, who embraces utilitarianism, wouldn't necessarily hold that view because, in his case, the utilitarian calculus may, in some circumstances, yield the conclusion that even a person, an innocent person, can legitimately be killed for the sake of a higher or greater good. Well, the natural law understanding of human rights I'm here sketching is connected with a particular account of human dignity, and I owe you this account so that you can judge whether you think I've got it right or wrong. Under this account, the natural human capacities, these at least rudimentary human capacities for reason and freedom, are fundamental to the dignity of human beings, the dignity that is protected by human rights, what we honor when we honor human rights, even when honoring them comes at a cost. The basic goods of human nature are the goods of a rational creature, that is, a creature who is characterized by a rational nature, a creature whose nature is to be reasonable, a creature who, unless impaired or prevented from doing so, naturally develops and exercises capacities for deliberation, judgment, and choice. Now, these capacities, I put it to you, are, in a very literal sense, godlike, albeit, of course, in a limited way. I'm not arguing that we're God. I'm saying that these capacities are godlike. In fact, from the theological vantage point, if I can shift there just for a moment, these capacities constitute a certain sharing, limited, of course, to be sure, but real, in divine power. This is what is meant, I believe, by the otherwise extraordinarily puzzling biblical teaching that man is made in the very image and likeness of God. After all, what else could it mean? I mean, to say that man is made in the image and likeness of God can't mean that God has five fingers on each of two hands and hair on his head and a nose. It must mean something else. Well, what does it mean? Well, it seems to me that it is intelligible as meaning that like God, human beings exercise freedom. They're capable of acting for the sake of more than merely instrumental reasons, which means, in other words, that they are capable of causing things they are not caused to cause. They're capable of rationality all the way down and freedom, whatever our limitations, and they are great. But whether or not one recognizes biblical authority, or even believes in a personal God, it's true that human beings possess a power traditionally ascribed to divinity, that is, namely, the power to cause things we're not caused to cause, freedom of the will, which is reciprocally entailed by the capacity to act on more than merely instrumental reasons. This is the power to envisage a possible state of affairs that does not exist, to see the point, to grasp the point of bringing it into being, to see the value of making it into a reality, and then to act by choice on one's reasons and not merely by impulse or instinct as a brute animal would to bring it into being. Now, that state of affairs may not be something profound. It might be a great painting or a profound piece of music or something else of great historical significance, but more commonly it's just our ordinary day-to-day activities where we act on reasons to make things happen that otherwise wouldn't happen. But we're not caused to make them happen, rather we cause them to happen out of our judgment that it's worth making them happen. It can be anything from the development of an intellectual skill or the attainment of an item of knowledge to the creation or critical appreciation of a work of art, to the establishment of friendships. Its moral or cultural significance may be great or comparatively minor. What matters for the point I'm now making is that it's a product of human reason and freedom, and not just a brute cause. It's the fruit of deliberation, judgment, and choice, even if the deliberation is effortless and swift. So effortless and swift that you don't ordinarily think of whether you're even deliberating. You gotta have to break the whole thing down like Lonergan does in the Insight book to see that what you're actually doing is thinking. Now, of course, a further question will present itself to the mind of anyone who recognizes the God-likeness of our capacities for rationality and freedom, capacities that are immaterial in nature. That question is whether beings capable of such powers could exist apart from some divine source or ground of their being. So one finds in the affirmation of these powers, it seems to me, a ground for the rejection of materialism. And one discerns the basis of an openness to and even the roots of an argument for theism. But more on that in a few minutes. Now, that's my account of human dignity. What about the authority for this view of human nature, the human good, human dignity, and human rights? I owe you that too. Well, here it is. Natural law theorists, as such, what makes you a natural law theorist, are interested in the intelligible reasons people have for their choices and actions, and in the integral prescriptivity or directiveness of those reasons. We're particularly interested in reasons that can be identified without appeal to any authority apart from the authority of reason itself. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not denying that it's often reasonable to recognize and submit to authority, whether it's religious authority, the authority of the Bible, or the tradition of the church, or the magisterium of the church, or legal authority, political authority, in deciding what to do or not do. Often, it's not only reasonable, but morally required that we submit to authority, it seems to me. And indeed, natural law theorists have made important contributions to understanding why and how people can sometimes be morally bound to submit to authority and be guided in their action by authority of various types. So those of you who know a bit of modern philosophy might think of the contributions of Yves Simone, the late Yves Simone of the University of Chicago, or Elizabeth Anscombe of Cambridge University, or John Finnis of Oxford University. But even here, the special concern of natural law theorists is with the reasons people have for recognizing and honoring claims to authority. We do not simply appeal to authority to justify authority. We would regard that as an illegitimate move. Of course, one might then ask whether human beings are in fact rational in the way that I've been claiming we are. Are we rational in anything more than a merely instrumental sense? Well, this is a big question and a big challenge to the natural law approach, sometimes called skepticism or or subjectivism, or ethical non-cognitivism. The question is, can we discern, as I'm claiming we can, trying to demonstrate from your own experience that we can, any intelligible reasons for human choices and actions? Now, of course, everybody in the debate recognizes that some ends or purposes pursued through human action are intelligible, at least insofar as they provide means to other ends. For example, people work to earn money, and they're doing so as perfectly rational and perfectly intelligible. No one scratches their head when they find out that someone has taken a job, maybe a second job, in order to earn some extra money. Right? That's intelligible. Now, it's not intelligible, though, just as an end in itself. If someone were working long hours to earn money just for the sake of the money, the little green paper, or the figures in a bank account, but had no interest in what the money could be used for, again, we'd be sending for the guys with the white coats. The question, then, is not whether some things provide instrumental reasons for action. Earning money is a good example. The question is whether some ends or purposes are intelligible as providing more than merely instrumental reasons for acting. Are there intrinsic as well as instrumental goods? Skeptics deny that there are any intelligible ends or purposes that make possible rationally motivated action. Natural law theorists, by contrast, hold that friendship, knowledge, critical aesthetic appreciation, the development of skills, the appreciation of skills, and certain other ends or purposes are intrinsically valuable. They're intelligibly choice-worthy not merely as means, but as ends in themselves. And they cannot be reduced to, nor can their intelligible appeal be accounted for exclusively in terms of emotion or feeling or desire or any other subrational motivating factor. These basic human goods are the constitutive aspects of the well-being and fulfillment of human beings, human persons, and the communities they form, and they thereby provide the foundations of our moral judgments, including our judgments pertaining to justice and human rights. Don't enslave people. Don't exploit people. Don't despoil the environment of poor people in the third world for the sake of money or whatever. Now, of course, there are plenty of people today who embrace philosophical or ideological doctrines that deny the human capacities I maintain are at the core of human dignity. They adopt a purely instrumental or essentially non-cognitivist view of practical reason, the view that was most famously articulated by David Hume, the 18th century skeptical British philosopher who put it this way. Hume said that reason is, speaking of practical reason now, reasons for action. Hume said, reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions, the slave of the passions, and may pretend to no office other than to serve and obey them. The ends people pursue, Hume and his followers insist, are ultimately given by non-rational motivating factors such as feeling, emotion, desire, what he called wonderful 18th century language, the passions. In this, actually, Hume is very much in line with his predecessor, the great English political philosopher Thomas Hobbes, who basically expressed the same thought, and he did it this way. Hobbes said, the thoughts are to the desires, the thoughts, the mind, the intellect. The thoughts are to the desires, as scouts and spies to range abroad and find the way to the thing desired. Again, the purely instrumental view of reason. Reason can't tell you what to want or adjudicate among possible wants. It can only tell you how to get what you want or how to get what you want more efficiently. So on this Hobbesian Humean view, truly rationally motivated action is just impossible for people like us, creatures like us. There are no more than merely instrumental reasons for action, no basic human goods. Now, if proponents of this view of human action are right, then it seems to me that the entire business of ethics is a charade and human dignity is a myth. I don't know how you would do the rescue, there are some people who think you can, of ethics from that understanding of human action and motivation. But I don't think they are right. Indeed, I don't think that they can give any account of the norms of rationality to which they must themselves appeal in trying to make the case against reason and freedom that is consistent with the denial that people are capable of more than merely instrumental rationality and true freedom of choice. For anyone who's interested in this issue, I've debated it in a way that I think is illuminating with a terrific philosopher from Australia named Jeffrey Goldsworthy, who defends the Humean position against my criticisms, and then I state my reasons for thinking that his critique fails. In an exchange, his was published in the 1996 volume of the American Journal of Jurisprudence, And mine was published in as the first chapter of my book, In Defense of Natural Law. So anyone who's interested in that debate and in the fleshed-out version of the argument that I just glancingly referred to here, you can have a look at that debate. Now, I don't deny that emotion figures in human action. This is not a debate between people who say all our action is emotionally motivated and people who say all of our action is rationally motivated. I don't think there's any action that's purely rationally motivated where emotion doesn't figure. But, and here's what the real debate is about, I maintain that people can have, and often do have, basic reasons for their actions, reasons provided by ends that they understand, that they grasp with the mind as humanly fulfilling and desire precisely as such. There are some things that we wouldn't desire but for our intelligent grasp of the intelligible point, the fulfillments on offer in the activity. That's my thesis. And these ends, too, figure in motivation. Now, if I and other natural law theorists are correct in affirming that human reason can identify human rights as genuine grounds of obligation to others, how can we explain or understand widespread failures to recognize and respect human rights and other moral principles? Well, as human beings, we are rational animals, but we are imperfectly rational. We are prone to making intellectual and moral mistakes and capable of behaving grossly unreasonably, especially when deflected by powerful emotions that run contrary to the demands of reasonableness, an experience that we all have. Christians have a name for this. They call it sin, or another name, fallenness. But you don't have to be a Christian. And all the great pre-Christian and non-Christian philosophers have all understood the same basic phenomenon, that we are imperfect. We're imperfect in our rationality. We are prone to doing things that where we're motivated not by reason but by emotion, where emotion gets the whip hand. And instead of our souls now being ordered in the way Plato taught us was proper, with reason in control of emotion, things get reversed, and now emotion is in control. And what happens to reason? It gets instrumentalized. It functions the way the humans think reason has to function, often in the cause of producing rationalizations for exploitation or other unjust or immoral acts that at some level we know are wrong. We suffer weakness of will and darkness of intellect. Even when following our consciences, as we're morally bound to do, we can go wrong. A judgment made in good conscience can nevertheless be an erroneous judgment. Good people can not only do bad things, but think bad things, be mistaken about really important moral issues. Of course, sometimes people fail to recognize and respect human rights because they have self-interested motives for doing so. In most cases of exploitation, for example, it seems to me the fundamental failing is moral, not intellectual. In some cases, though, intellectual and moral failures are closely connected. Selfishness, prejudice, partisanship, vanity, avarice, lust, ill will, and other moral delinquencies can, in ways that are sometimes quite subtle, and we all know this from our own lives, impede sound ethical judgments, not only prevent us from doing what we know to be right, but interfere with our understanding of what the right thing to do is, including our judgments pertaining to justice and human rights. Whole cultures or subcultures can be infected with moral failings that blind large numbers of people to truths about justice and human rights, and ideologies hostile to these truths will almost always be both causes and effects of failings. Consider, for example, the case of slavery in our own country. The ideology of white supremacy was both a cause of many people's blindness to the wickedness of slavery and an effect of the exploitation and degradation of the slaves. Let's now turn, as I promised a few minutes ago we would, more fully to the question of God and religious faith in natural law theory. Most contemporary natural law theorists are theists, mostly Christians, but also some Jews and Muslims. I say most, but not all. One of the most prominent contemporary natural law theorist, Michael Moore of the University of Illinois Law School, is an atheist, but a natural law theorist. But in any event, the majority who are religious believers believe that the moral order, like every other order in human experience, is what it is because God creates and sustains it as such. In accounting for the intelligibility of the created order, they infer the existence of a free and creative intelligence, a personal God. They argue that God's creative free choice provides the only ultimately satisfactory account of the existence of the intelligibilities humans grasp in every domain of inquiry, not just in ethics or the moral domain, but in the domain of nature that we study in physics or chemistry or molecular biology, or in the social sciences and history, or in logic, where we have to bring norms that govern our thinking into our deliberation in any other field to do it well. Or in the technical domain, the domain that Aristotle labeled techne, which concerns the bringing of efficient means to bear for the realization of preordained ends. Now, natural law theorists do not deny that God can reveal moral truths, and most believe that God has chosen to reveal many such truths. However, natural law theorists also affirm that many moral truths, including some that are revealed, can also be grasped by ethical reflection, even apart from revelation. They assert, or believe with St. Paul, that there is a law written on the hearts, even of the Gentiles who did not know the law of Moses, a law the knowledge of which is sufficient for moral accountability. So the basic norms against murder and theft, for example, though revealed in the Decalogue, are knowable even apart from God's special revelation. The natural law can be known by us, and we can conform our conduct to its terms by virtue of our natural human capacities for deliberation, judgment, and choice. Now, the absence of a divine source of the natural law would be a puzzling thing, just as the absence of a divine source of any and every other intelligible order in human experience would be a puzzling thing. An atheist's puzzlement might well cause him to reconsider the idea that there's no divine source of the order we perceive and understand in the universe, and many atheists have become theists precisely out of that kind of reconsideration. Anscombe herself is an example, Geech, Michael Dummett, John Finnis, Alasdair MacIntyre, most recently Anthony Flew. It's far less likely, I think, to cause someone to conclude that our perception is illusory or that our understanding is a sham, though that is certainly possible. There's no logical reason that that couldn't be. The question then arises, can natural law, assuming that there are truly principles of natural law, provide common moral and even perhaps some political ground for people who do not agree on the existence or the nature of God and the role of God in human affairs? Well, in my view, anybody who acknowledges the human capacities for reason and freedom has good grounds for affirming human dignity and basic human rights. On this, I agree with another of my colleagues, Jeffrey Stout, in Princeton's Department of Religion, a very distinguished scholar, who is a self-professed atheist, but who nevertheless believes in human rights and believes that we have good grounds for affirming human dignity and human rights in virtue of the capacities that the Bible identifies in Genesis 1, or that I infer from Genesis 1 the Bible has in mind when it talks about man being made in the image and likeness of God. These capacities for reason and freedom. Creatures possessing those, Stout agrees with me, demand, call out for, deserve a special kind of treatment with respect, not being reducible to mere means to other ends, although he and I disagree on the God question. How can there be such realities in the universe? How can the state of affairs that I think does call out for our respect exist? My own account of it would be theistic. He doesn't offer an account, but he doesn't think the theistic account is any better than any other account. For him, it's just a mystery, ultimately a mystery. But these grounds remain in place, both of us suppose, whether or not one adverts to the question, is there a divine source of the moral order whose tenets we discern in inquiry regarding natural law and natural rights? As I've said, I happen to think the answer to that question is yes, and that we should be open to the possibility that God has revealed himself in ways that reinforce and supplement what can be known by what philosophers call unaided reason. But we do not need to agree on the answer to the God question, so long as we agree about the truths that give rise to the question. Namely, that human beings, possessing those godlike, literally awesome, awe-inspiring powers of reason and freedom, are bearers of a profound dignity that is protected by certain basic rights. So if there is a set of moral norms, including norms of justice and human rights, that can be known by rational inquiry, understanding, and judgment, even apart from any special revelation, then these norms of natural law can provide the basis for a common understanding of human rights, at least some level of common understanding. I don't want to overstate it. At least some measure of common understanding. An understanding that can be shared even in the absence of religious agreement. And for this, I have at least a little bit of empirical evidence. And that empirical evidence is set forth in Marianne Glendon's, the great Harvard Law professor Marianne Glendon's, wonderful book called A World Made New, which is an account of the drafting by a diverse group of intellectuals representing a range of religious traditions of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of 1948, where across the lines of theological and philosophical division, there was some ability to reach common ground on at least some basic human rights. Of course, we should not expect consensus because we're not going to get it. There are moral skeptics who deny that there are any moral truths, or who believe that moral truths are just projections of feeling or emotion. They're not really truths in any meaningful sense at all. There are religious fideists in many different traditions who hold that moral truths cannot be known apart from God's special revelation. So you either got them by virtue of revelation, or you don't, because reason has no purchase on them. It's only by revelation in our book that you can have them. And even among those who believe in natural law, of course, there will be differences of opinion about its precise content and implication for certain issues. Natural law theorists do plenty of debating among themselves. There's a very big debate that's been going on in the blogosphere in the past few weeks about the ethics of lying in a good cause, whether lying is always wrong, or whether lying is wrong most of the time but not all of the time, or whether untruths that are justified are not really lies. And it's a debate among natural law theorists. So it is, I believe, our permanent condition to discuss and debate these issues, both as a matter of abstract philosophy and as a matter of practical politics. But that's not so bad because it's going to keep some of us employed. Now, it's sometimes regarded as an embarrassment to the natural law tradition that some great ancient and medieval figures in the tradition failed to recognize and indeed have even denied human rights that are affirmed by contemporary natural law theorists and even regarded as fundamental. Consider, for example, the basic human right to religious liberty. This right was not widely acknowledged in the past and was even denied by some prominent representatives of the natural law tradition. As Professor Finnis has observed, they wrongly believed that a wide conception of liberty in matters of faith presupposed religious relativism or indifferentism, or entailed that religious vows are immoral or non-binding, or the comprehensive subservience of ecclesial communities to the state. In other words, they identified religious liberty with the French Revolutionary idea of religious liberty and didn't consider that there might be another account of religious liberty like the one that eventually became embodied in the Constitution of the United States. It's interesting that when the Catholic Church put itself on record firmly in support of the robust right of religious freedom, which didn't happen until 1965 in the Second Vatican Council in a document called Dignitatis Humanae, human dignity, it presented both a natural law argument, that was the first half of the document, and an argument from specifically theological sources, the second half. The natural law argument for religious liberty is founded on the obligation of each person to pursue the truth about religious matters and to live in conformity with his best judgments, his conscientious judgments, whether they are theistic or atheistic, wherever they lead. This obligation is in turn rooted in the proposition that religion, considered as conscientious truth-seeking regarding the ultimate sources of meaning and value, if any, is a crucial dimension of the well-being and fulfillment of human beings. It is among those basic human goods that provide rational motivation for our choosing. They're aspects of our flourishing, to make that quest, to seek, to look, to try to understand one's relationship to what is more than merely human, indeed what is ultimate. It's an aspect of our well-being. The right to religious liberty follows from the dignity of man, dignitatis humanae, as a conscientious truth seeker. Let me conclude with just a couple of additional points to fill out the picture. You might be wondering, how does this account relate to, how is it like, and how is it different from the leading contenders. So if ethical skepticism is on one side, what about those theories that hold, or people who believe, schools of thought that have it, that there are right answers to ethical questions? We can raise ethical questions. We can answer ethical questions. How's the natural law tradition like the major competitors and unlike them? Well, like utilitarian approaches, to take one of the two main competitors, like utilitarian approaches and unlike what are sometimes called Kantian or deontological approaches, natural law theories are fundamentally concerned with human well-being and fulfillment, and indeed take the basic aspects of our flourishing as human beings as the starting points of ethical reflection. Natural law theorists are Aristotelians. They believe in that ethics is fundamentally about what Aristotle called eudaimonia, the sometimes I think poorly translated as happiness. It's really about flourishing, the being all you can be. Unlike utilitarian approaches, however, natural law theorists understand the basic forms of human good, at least as they figure in options for morally significant choosing, as incommensurable in ways that render senseless and unworkable, therefore, the utilitarian strategy of choosing the option that overall and in the long run promises to produce the net best proportion of benefit to harm, however benefit and harm may be understood and defined. This is the upshot of the point I was making earlier, that in this tradition, goodness is predicated of all the different aspects of human well-being and fulfillment, not univocally, as if they all have the same substance and just manifest it differently or in different degrees, but rather only analogically. Each is a fundamental and irreducible aspect of our well-being, which is variegated. Natural law theorists share with Kantians the rejection of aggregative accounts of morality that regard the achievement of sufficiently good consequences, or the avoidance of sufficiently bad ones, as justifying choices that would be excluded by application of moral principles in ordinary circumstances. Unlike Kantians, however, we do not believe that moral norms can be identified and justified apart from some consideration of the integral directiveness of the principles of practical reason, directing human choice and action toward what is humanly fulfilling and away from what is contrary to it, toward what is good in the sense of providing for the fulfillment of human beings and away from the privations of those goods. Natural law theorists do not believe, that is to say, in purely deontological moral norms. So practical reasoning is reasoning about both the right and the good, and the two are connected. The content of the human good shapes moral norms, precisely in as much as the moral norms are entailments of the basic aspects of human well-being and fulfillment, considered integrally, considered in their wholeness, in their variegated wholeness. Let me conclude then with one more proposition that is central to thinking about natural law, namely the fact, or in any event what we believe to be the fact, that by our choices and actions, as Aristotle taught us, we not only alter states of affairs in the world external to us, we not only affect what's out there by what we do, but at the same time, in all of our choices and actions, we shape or determine ourselves, we constitute ourselves, for better or worse, as people with a certain character, a dynamic orientation in a certain direction. Recognition of this self-shaping, or what philosophers sometimes call intransitive quality of morally significant choosing, leads in the tradition to a focus on virtues, considered as habits born of upright choosing that orient and dispose us toward further upright choosing. Worried about virtue because you want your kids to be good people. You want them to be good people in the sense that they will do the right thing and that they'll be dynamically sort of oriented toward doing the right thing. And they'll be able to resist the temptation to do the wrong thing because they've built a strong character that can withstand temptation, at least in the hardest cases and most important cases. People sometimes ask, is natural law about rules or virtues? that question, I think, is almost a peculiarly contemporary one, where some people seem to think that it's got to be about one or the other. Right? So we have people who call themselves virtue theorists, and we have people who say, no, we need a rule-based morality. Well, the answer to that question, at least as I see it, is that ethics, natural law, is about both rules and virtues. A complete theory of natural law will identify norms for distinguishing right from wrong, moral norms, as well as habits or traits of character whose cultivation disposes people to choose in conformity with the norms and thus compatibly with what we might call, borrowing again a phrase from our friend Kant, a good will. That is, a will toward integral human fulfillment. Thank you for your exemplary patience. So you all got that.
Actually, I can start with a question.
Yeah, go ahead, Rick.
So one of the issues that has been discussed is the place of natural law reasoning in decision-making by courts, either interpretation of statutes or the Constitution. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah. There is a debate which... I believe is an unnecessary one, a debate that misfires, about whether belief in natural law, belief that there are principles of natural law, that there is a higher law in the light of which we can judge the merely human or positive law. The inference that because there is such a law, that anyone who is empowered under a constitutional system to say what the law is must give effect to his or her best judgment as to what the higher law requires, where he judges that the positive law is in conflict with the higher law. So the idea here would be that, say, the Supreme Court of the United States, or the Attorney General, or whoever it is, a governor, can disregard what lawyers ordinarily think of as the law, what's in the statute books, or the prevailing precedent, or whatever comes from the legal sources, and give effect to his own best judgments of what justice requires, because after all, the natural law is law, and it's superior law. No, in my view. And my view is rooted in a principle of the natural law tradition itself. And that principle is called the rule of law. There is nothing in the natural law, there's no principle of natural law which vests judges or other constitutional interpreters or legal officials with the authority to act on the basis of their best judgments of natural law in defiance of the positive law. Constitutions allocate authority. Now, they can do it in different ways. There's no uniquely best natural law constitution. Different constitutions can allocate authority differently. Some can, it's perfectly reasonable, perfectly legitimate to have an American system that gives judges the power to review legislation and check its constitutionality. It's perfectly reasonable to have the British system, or at least what used to be the British system before European integration, a parliamentary sovereignty and supremacy, where judges have no right to overturn the acts of Parliament, even if they believe that it's in violation of the historic, unwritten British Constitution. Constitutions can allocate what we ordinarily think of legislative authority in some measure to courts. I'm told that there are some constitutions, I believe the Indian Constitution is one that does that. Ours, in theory, doesn't do that, although in practice, judges have often treated it as though it did, while all the while denying that it does. Professor Dworkin claims that they're right to do it, but wrong to deny that they're doing it, in his famous article, The Moral Reading of the Constitution. He argued that properly interpreted, our Constitution does shift a certain amount of legislative authority to judges to act for the sake of what's morally right. Now, I have no problem with any of those constitutional systems. I do have a problem with any official in any basically just system, that is, any system that doesn't deserve to be subverted. So we're not talking about the Nazi system here, which it would be right to subvert. I have a big problem with any official in any system seizing and acting on more power than he's been allocated in the constitutional setup, whether it's an official written constitutional document or the unwritten law that establishes how authority is distributed. And my reason for that is that principle that I mentioned a few minutes ago, Randy, the principle of the rule of law. What the rule of law principle preserves the idea that we don't rely simply on the arbitrary judgments, even of wise men. That for the wise man to be given the right to rule, he's got to be given it under the Constitution. The consequences of not obeying that rule end up being historically disastrous, because arbitrary power is always abused. You might like it today, because the guy exercising arbitrary power is doing it in a way you just think is peachy keen, but you're not going to like it tomorrow when somebody else gets the power. It's kind of like signing statements, right? When it's a Republican president and he does signing statements, the Democrats say, oh, that's a nightmare. He's doing signing statements. He's violating the Constitution. And when it's a Democratic president, the Democratic president does signing statements and the Republicans say, oh, that's an outrage, arbitrary power, you know, violating the Constitution. I think, you know, we have to step back from this kind of partisanship and just realize that arbitrary power is almost always a really bad idea. Now, the rule of law, in my view, is not an absolute. There are some times for severe, grave reasons when the principle of the rule of law can be violated. Sometimes people just have to exercise power. For example, where a catastrophe has happened and there is no really functioning legal system. But somebody can get control of the situation, perhaps out of sheer power, because he's got the gang with the guns. And then it's his obligation, if he's willing to live up to it, but it certainly is his obligation, to act in a way that best comports with judgment, with justice as best he can understand it. But by and large, in most cases, the rule of law should be respected. And when judges or other constitutional interpreters with the best of motives for the sake of doing justice violate the positive law for the sake of the higher law, they violate the rule of law. Yeah. Right. Although the goods themselves are not, I'm not using good there in a moral sense. Yeah, provide a more than merely instrumental reason for an aspect of our fulfillment. Yeah.
Here's another example. Some people might judge truly for the instrumental good of health, but others might find it intrinsically fulfilling. So, what is it about these activities that demand that?
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of difference out in the world about moral principles and moral judgments, but there really isn't a lot of difference out there in the world about what has an intelligible point and what doesn't. Now, where there are differences, they're almost always reducible to social conventions that obscure the intelligibility of the activity from people who come from outside the culture. So they think something's pointless is going on because they don't understand the social conventions in light of which the thing has a point. So our fundamental debates about ethics are not debates at the level of what is good and bad for human beings just as such, apart from the moral considerations. We really do not, we really lack any capacity to understand a point of Professor Beck or anybody else standing on one foot and opening and closing a door where that is not being done for some instrumental purpose. We really do understand the point of going to the hospital. We understand the point of jogging not only for its health benefits, but also for just for the sake of the fun that you have in jogging. Now, that doesn't mean that pleasure just considered as such provides a reason for acting. There are reasons to think that that couldn't be the case. And in any event, a term like pleasure turns out to be extremely problematic because it's not just one thing. It's a label that we use for a lot of different things. But we can understand that some people are, and all of us at various times, are motivated not simply by reasons, but also by just pleasant feelings. You're thirsty, you want to drink. Or you want to experience the feeling of spinning around in a circle or something like that. Okay, those are not actions that are realizations of aspects of our well-being and fulfillment, but they're intelligible as just providing pleasure in some of the many senses in one of the many senses in which we might use that term. But where someone, and this does happen sometimes, where someone isn't just enjoying the day, isn't doing something to make a point, isn't doing something to get some exercise or for any other intelligible reason, but is just doing something, perhaps doing it repetitively in a pointless way, we do worry about the person. We can see that there's something there that's not right. Not in a moral sense. This is not a character judgment. It's not a judgment of the morality of the thing. We're wondering what's going on with this guy, because the activity really does seem pointless, and in some cases it's because it really is pointless. Now, when you get to the level of morality, then the debate really does break out, because people really do fundamentally disagree about a lot of things there. And the further away from the most basic judgments we get, this is an old Aristotelian teaching, really, the further from the more basic principles we get, the more room for debate, disagreement, and error there will be. Yeah. Okay. Okay.